This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Many cities across the country are in the middle of downtown revivals, and many times what were once blighted neighborhoods move upscale. The influence of new and wealthier residents is good news for urban planners, local businesses, and for the coffers of city governments. Gentrification can, though, displace the old businesses and the old residents who can't afford the new and higher rents. So as hipsters, galleries, condos, and trendy restaurants arrive, poor and often minority people are forced to leave. At least, that's the conventional view. Now, a new study challenges that notion. It concludes that low-income residents of a gentrifying neighborhood do move away, not because they're forced to necessarily, but as a result of the population shift that affects all neighborhoods. Later in the program, the struggle to form a new government in Baghdad, and former Massachusetts Governor William Weld puts himself in the race to be the next governor of New York. But first, gentrification. Whether you've been priced out of a neighborhood or whether you're an urban pioneer, give us a call. The number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. The study that we're talking about is called Displacement or Succession, Residential Mobility in Gentrifying Neighborhoods. The author is Lance Freeman, assistant professor in the Urban Planning Program at Columbia University, and he joins us now from our bureau in New York. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me on.
Your study seems to contradict the common perception of gentrification. Were you surprised by what you found?
Well, this is actually the second in of two studies I've done that have looked at this question. I did an earlier study with a co-author of mine, a colleague of mine, Frank Bracconi, which actually looked at this question focusing specifically on New York City. And going into that study, what I was planning to do was to try to quantify the extent to which gentrification causes displacement. As you mentioned, there is a perception that gentrification drives displacement, but we really didn't have a sense of the magnitude of that relationship. So the study that I co-authored a couple of years ago in New York City attempted to try to do just that. In that study, we actually found that residents of gentrifying neighborhoods were actually less likely to move than residents of other neighborhoods. And because of the counterintuitive nature of that result, I wanted to try and see if this was a fluke or if I would find a similar pattern if I looked at another data set or if I looked, in other geographic areas. So actually, this national study, the one that you referred to, sort of was designed to try to verify the results that I attained specifically for New York City.
And did it bear it out?
Well, to some extent, it was a little different. The results in New York City actually showed that residents of gentrifying neighborhoods were less likely to move. The results, looking at the national study, actually showed there was no statistically significant difference between residents of gentrifying neighborhoods and residents of other neighborhoods. That is, if you look at the overall mobility rates, they were similar across both types of neighborhoods. Now, one addition that I was able to do with the national study, I was actually able to look at displacement specifically rather than just looking at whether or not someone moved. That is, the data I used actually had information about why people moved. In other words, people were asked why they moved. And in this national study, there actually was a relationship between people saying they had to move and living in a gentrifying neighborhood. In other words, the likelihood of someone saying they were displaced was higher in the gentrifying neighborhoods. However, the magnitude was fairly small. We're talking about a half of a percentage point. And so in that way, it is somewhat consistent with the earlier study because neither study seemed to find widespread displacement in terms of explaining how these neighborhoods are changing demographically.
Mm-hmm. Well, how is it that people who are able to afford the rent when it's the wrong side of the track, suddenly when it's the place to live in town, those rents go up? How are they able to stay?
Well, I think there's a number of mechanisms at play, and there's actually been recent work or forthcoming work by some scholars at Rutgers University and the University of British Columbia, in addition to some work that I've done, And what we found is that, well, there's one, many residents of these neighborhoods will end up paying a very high proportion of their income in rent. In other words, as the rents go up, they may stay, but they find themselves paying an increasing proportion of their income for rent. Two, and this is particularly the case in New York City, many residents are in some type of subsidized housing. In New York City, quite often it's rent regulation, rent controlled or rent stabilized apartments. It could be public housing, it could be affordable housing developed through the low-income housing tax credit or the like. So many people have some type of housing subsidy. Then there's also some people are homeowners, and some people who are of relatively limited means also still may be fortunate enough to own their home and have perhaps purchased their home before gentrification struck the neighborhood. In addition, some people will decide to double up with friends or family as a means of being able to afford to stay in the apartment or to stay in their home. So there are a number of mechanisms by which people are able to stay in these neighborhoods. And let me add just one other thing. One other thing that I've found is that in some cases, landlords might have a long-standing relationship with the tenant, right? Maybe the tenant has been living there 10 or 15 years, and they may be hesitant to just suddenly double the rent and force that person to leave. So they might value the fact that this is a reliable tenant, a tenant that doesn't cause problems. And even though the market rent is increasing, the landlord might not charge what the market will bear. So I think there are a number of mechanisms through which people are able to stay in a gentrifying neighborhood, even though they might be of limited means.
We're talking with Lance Freeman at Columbia University about gentrification and his study about the degree to which people are forced to move as a result of that gentrification. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, TOTN at NPR.org. And we have a call from Casey, who's with us from Salt Lake City in Utah.
Hi, how's it going?
All right.
Good. Well, I had a comment. I'm an art historian here in Utah, and I found that up on the east side of Salt Lake, a lot of gentrification has been happening, and it's a lot of the artists have come there mainly for diversification and to, you know, get a glimpse of that city life. But as rents increase and prices increase, the majority white population with a lot of money have forced a lot of that diversification out of the city and, you know, made it more not as unique as it was before. And I don't know if that has been occurring nationwide or if that's a problem that is something that has been considered or if it's just locally, but I'll take my answer off there.
Yeah, thank you, Casey. And Professor Freeman, a lot of people do say, look, the character of the neighborhood changes once you start getting, the Starbucks and the Gap.
That's true. And I would clarify something about the study. The study really speaks to the extent to which how quickly people are leaving the neighborhood. One thing, an additional point that the study makes is that neighborhoods change not only because of how quickly people leave a neighborhood, but by changing who's able to move into the neighborhood as well. And so it's certainly the case that when neighborhoods undergo gentrification, over time, the demographic composition of the neighborhood is going to change. And notwithstanding the fact that some people are able to stay in the neighborhood, you will certainly find that lower income households are less likely to be able to move into the neighborhood. As a result, the neighborhood is going to change its demographic composition. It's going to become more affluent over time. I think that's consistent with the results that I presented in the study.
Okay, let's talk now with Dave, and Dave's calling from Portland, Oregon.
Hi, pleasure to be on the show.
Thank you.
Just calling because I'm calling from the Alberta Arts District in Northeast Portland here. Or I just wanted to make a quick comment how the change from, let's say, 1990 to now has got to be the greatest change in any neighborhood ever recorded in the history of man. For instance, my father bought his house for $4,000 in 1990, and it's somewhere around $300,000 now. So, just things have really changed, and it's great to see this program on the show.
Thanks very much. There was a clip about that particular neighborhood that was at the beginning of the program, and one of the things the longtime resident said about that neighborhood, Professor Freeman, was, look, not so very long ago we had gangs, we had burned out buildings, we had a lot of fear in this community, and now things are really improving. Gentrification can really help a lot of neighborhoods.
That's true. I mean, I think gentrification can be viewed almost as a double-edged sword. I think particularly depending on the context, if you take a neighborhood like the neighborhood that you just described in Portland, a neighborhood that experienced a lot of disinvestment, you know, a lot of vacant buildings, a lot of abandonment, the flight of the middle class, not much in the ways of stores and amenities. It's certainly the case that gentrification can bring new investment into the neighborhood. And with that, not only you'll get trendy boutiques, but you'll also get sort of basic everyday services that everyone might be willing to take advantage of. The downside, again, as has been stressed, is people's fear of displacement, the fact that low-income households may no longer be able to move into the neighborhood, and also conflicts around the social interactions that are taking place in the neighborhood. Anytime you have a new group coming into a neighborhood, particularly a new group of a different class and perhaps a different race, that could ignite conflict over what's the appropriate use of public space, what are accepted behavioral norms. And I think some of the controversy around gentrification is due to that conflict in addition to the fear of the loss of affordable housing.
We're going to be talking about those conflicts and others after we return from a short break. We'll also be talking with a high school student who filmed her neighborhood as it went through the experience of gentrification. Again, if you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. You can send us email as well, and the address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking today about the emotional issue of gentrification and the degree to which the arrival of new and often wealthier residents forces out the poor and often minority residents who used to live there. Our guest is Lance Freeman, who's at Columbia University's Urban Planning Program. Of course, you're invited to join us. Our number is 800-989-8255. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Residents of Baltimore's Pigtown neighborhood, which is just west of the Orioles' Camden Yards ballpark and the Ravens' football stadium, notice a lot more luxury cars with D.C. and Virginia plates driving around their streets these days. The visitors are looking at real estate. Joining us now is Bill McLennan, Executive Director of Paul's Place Outreach Center, who can talk about the imminent changes to this working-class community. He's with us by phone from his office in Baltimore. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Neil.
Describe Pigtown for us. How did it get its name, for one thing?
Well, Pigtown has always had a strong work ethic, and it actually got its name from the pigs literally running in the streets from the stockyards. The B&O Railroad had a major presence here in the neighborhood, and I guess at the turn of the last century, it was not uncommon for pigs to literally be running down the street.
And what's the makeup of the neighborhood these days, the racial makeup, for one thing?
Well, our neighborhood is really, truly diverse, and that's a definite plus. You know, it's approximately 50% Caucasian and 50% African American, and there's also a small Asian complex as well.
And what signs do you see that the area is being gentrified?
Well, you can literally see the scaffolding from street to street. You can see that people are tearing down the old traditional Baltimore formstone and coming back to a more traditional look in their housing stock. And as was mentioned,
Mm-hmm.
You know, you'll see plates from out of town, realtors that are looking for investment opportunities. With the prices in Washington rising dramatically, you know, young families can't afford to live in Washington, and so they're looking to Baltimore as an alternative. And Pigtown is conveniently located next to Interstate 95 and the Amtrak stations, And so we're seeing an influx from Washington.
And our longtime residents, are they being forced out?
Yes, they are. And that's one of the challenges, is to maintain affordable housing for those that have lived here for generations.
How many, do we know?
Well, at this point, we've seen dramatic increase in the last 6 months in activity. And so I think we're really just on the start. There is a housing, brand-new townhome community that's Camden Crossing that's had its first residents move in. It's been planned for well over 4 years, but the first residents are just moving in now. And, you know, they tend to be young urban professional families without children. And so the one plus, I'm sure, as Lance has mentioned earlier, is that it will bring economic diversity so that there will be additional dollars and hopefully additional retail services for everyone in the neighborhood, and that's a plus.
Okay. Inner Baltimore has been undergoing a transformation, I guess, ever since the Inner Harbor renovation project. Of course, the stadiums, Camden Yards and the Ravens Stadium there, have accelerated all that. This can't come as any surprise to the people who live in Pigtown.
Well, certainly not from an overall city standpoint, but I think it is a surprise at the how quickly it's starting to happen and how quickly interest has sparked here in this neighborhood. I mean, there are several neighborhoods that are close to 95. It's interesting that the interest is being focused on this one at this time.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Bill McLennan is Executive Director of Paul's Place Outreach Center in Baltimore, and he joined us from his office in the Pigtown neighborhood of Baltimore. Lance Freeman, that's a story that we hear in city after city.
Yes, it is. I think, as you mentioned, we're in the midst of some would say, a housing bubble, particularly in large cities along the coast. And so what that's doing is it's causing people to look for housing in neighborhoods that in the past they perhaps would have overlooked. So people who in the past perhaps would have looked for housing in Washington, D.C. are now looking in Baltimore. And so you're having some sort of a ripple effect.
Let's get another caller on the line. And this is Melissa. Melissa is joining us from Minneapolis.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Let's see. I'm kind of the person that you were describing in the first segment of the show, someone who has miraculously managed to hang on to their studio in an area that has been kind of overrun by lofts. I've been here 22 years. And I just wanted to emphasize extreme exception. There, I'm surprised by the previous speaker's data that people managed to hang on, because I've seen it really decimate an artistic community where developers will just empty these warehouses, 50, 100, 200 tenants that are on the streets looking for studios. But my kind of larger question or point is, okay, I guess we all sort of get it. Gentrification happens. We're not going to change it. Artists are kind of powerless in the face of it. But you'd think, well, okay, all these people that are moving into my neighborhood and taking over these underused and old industrial buildings that we've all had our studios in, maybe in sort of the natural kind of looking at it as an ecosystem, we would then go to where they vacated. But the problem is that people that are moving into these spaces are like leaving suburban houses or townhomes or condominiums. Artists can't work in these kind of places. There's no, we need these old industrial buildings. And when artists are forced to kind of go out and like try to work, buy a house or work in an apartment, a condo, communities are totally fragmented. Nobody's near each other anymore, and their workspace is totally inappropriate.
Yeah, Lance Freeman, that sort of density is important to artists and to a lot of other people who want that kind of area. And again, I'm just interested in your statistics that suggest this doesn't happen all that often. And I guess anecdotal evidence from Pigtown and from Melissa as well, and certainly they're not the only ones, this seems to be overwhelming.
That's true. I don't think the study says that people are not displaced, or that you don't have circumstances where people are displaced. I think what you have to do, though, what the study does, is sort of looks at the question more broadly. And so if you look at not only one particular neighborhood, but across neighborhoods across time, the patterns suggest that the displacement and mobility rates are not as different for gentrifying neighborhoods as they are for other neighborhoods as perhaps we might expect. And so particularly in my studies, I really didn't focus on artists so much. I really focused on low-income households and renters. Mm-hmm. And particularly for those groups, mobility rates and displacement rates generally tend to be much higher than they are for the rest of the population. And so if you look at just a poor neighborhood that's not undergoing gentrification, what you'll find much higher displacement rates and much higher mobility rates than you would find in another neighborhood. And then when gentrification occurs, okay, what my study is really doing is looking at the counterfactual. It's saying, okay, well, what's the difference between what would have happened in this neighborhood had gentrification not occurred compared to what's happening now that gentrification is occurring? And that's where you don't see that much of a difference.
Here's an email question from Ben in St. Louis. Sounds like many lower-income people must rely on various mechanisms to remain in a gentrifying neighborhood, i.e. more people in each apartment. So the question is, at what point after gentrification was the sample taken for the study? How might these numbers change over the course of time, say 5 or 10 years out?
That's a good question. I use data starting at the beginning of each decade. So for looking at 1980 to 1990, I looked at
census data.
Right. Exactly. So I looked at data starting at the beginning of each decade going and followed over 10 years. So it is possible, since my study is only following people, you know, during that time period, I really can't speak for sure about what would happen after that 10-year period. It's, you know, certainly conceivable that might happen. But again, based on that analysis and also based on looking at some neighborhoods in New York City, it seems as though the process is a little bit more gradual, right? So gentrification starts, and certainly some people are forced to leave, some people are not able to move in the neighborhood, but gradually the neighborhood becomes more upscale. It doesn't always happen overnight, particularly a neighborhood that was predominantly residential. A neighborhood that was predominantly, say, manufacturing, that type of change perhaps happens more quickly because you have essentially empty buildings that were occupied by factories or the like, and mm-hmm. people are just sort of moving in and taking up residence there.
17-year-old Stephanie Cisneros saw signs of gentrification in her Los Angeles neighborhood of Echo Park long before she knew what that term meant. She's decided to borrow a video camera and document the changes after the community's gathering place and ethnic market announced that it was going to be closing its doors. Stephanie Cisneros is a high school junior and filmographer. She's made a documentary, Echo Park, A Different View, and joins us now from downtown Magnets High School in Los Angeles. Good of you to be with us today.
Hello. Hello, Neil.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you.
Good.
I wonder, how long have you lived in Echo Park, and what changes have you been able to document there with your camera?
Well, I've been living in Echo Park for 12 years, since I was 5 years old. My family moved here from Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
And the changes that I've seen is that a lot of rents are increasing. People are getting evicted. They don't know their rights, so they have to leave the area. They're being pushed out because they can't afford these high rents. They can't pay $1,000 for a one-bedroom because they have to think about the other things, the basic things. They need to pay the rent. They need to pay the bills. They need food.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they can't afford these high rents.
Well, the place you focused this movie on was a place called the Pioneer Market. Tell us a little bit about that.
Oh, well, Pioneer Market has been there for maybe 30 years or somewhere around there.
Mm-hmm.
And the owner decided to sell the place because, according to one article, the paying for the benefits for the employees were getting too high, so he just had to sell it. He's leasing it to Walgreens, so Walgreens is coming into the area, and it's weird to imagine Walgreens in Echo Park because Pioneer has been there for many years. I've interviewed some people about Pioneer, and they said that's a big loss because they said, you know, where am I going to buy my fruits and vegetables and the things that I needed? The prices were really low, and they were affordable to me, you know, because Echo Park is a low, well, most of the people that live there are low-income families.
Mm-hmm.
So Pioneer was a great place, and now it's gone because, you know, this big change that's occurring in Echo Park.
And Walgreens is a drugstore.
Yes, Walgreens is a drugstore.
Now, this has not happened without protest.
No. No. Well, there was only one incident that happened. The sign, it says Walgreens coming soon. One of my friends took a picture of it, and it said no. So some people are not welcoming Walgreens because, well, I guess they're attached to Pioneer because it's the new, you know, the new store.
Yeah. You do point out that there have been some positive changes in your movie.
I mean, for some people, you know, you have to see both sides and understand the other side. But in my point of view, I'm against gentrification because it's affecting us. The good parts, I guess, are that, you know, well, a lot of the people that have been living there for long periods of time, then the property values are going up. So that's good for them. But what about the people that are, you know, that are paying these high rents that are being affected by gentrification, that are being pushed out?
Mm-hmm.
The area is getting, you know, more policemen, more it's getting cleaner. But, you know, why couldn't the policemen come before all of this happened? Before, you know, when gentrification, I guess, you know, wasn't starting, or, you know, before long ago, before this, you know, before gentrification was noticeable, I guess you could say.
Good luck with the movie.
Thank you.
Stephanie Cisneros' movie is called Echo Park, A Different View. She's a student at Downtown Magnet's High School in Los Angeles. She joined us by phone from there. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Lance Freeman, let me ask you, these are, as Stephanie was talking about, sometimes very emotional issues. Sometimes gentrification is, it's as much about race, as you pointed out, as it is about economics.
That's true. And the point that she made, that people resent the fact that the neighborhood seems to be improving just as gentrification occurs, is something that I've also found in other research that I've been doing. And more specifically, people living in predominantly minority community feel like, you know, they've been living there 10, 15, 20 years, perhaps high levels of crime are tolerated, you know, unclean streets were tolerated. And it seems as though when gentrification occurs and then you see whites moving into the neighborhood, all of a sudden the services start to improve, stores start offering better products, the police seem to be more responsive, behaviors that were okay prior to gentrification are now no longer acceptable. And that sparks a lot of resentment. People feel like the newcomers, the changes are happening specifically for the benefit of the newcomers and not for the people who have been living there for a long period of time and sort of has struggled when the neighborhood was, you know, in a downturn. Mm-hmm. And that causes a lot of resentment and a lot of social friction.
Yeah, let's talk now with Marcel. Marcel's calling us from Oakland, California.
How you doing?
All right.
Yeah, so I'm calling from West Oakland, which is the birthplace of the Black Panther Party, as a lot of people know. And it's the most, the blackest area of Oakland, the historically blackest Oakland. Right now, we're going through the level of gentrification where there's a large amount of yuppies, you know, coming in from San Francisco, from the peninsula down in Palo Alto, and it's creating a culture war, you know, so not so much as being displaced because of economic reasons, but it's more so, you know, the new folks, white folks, don't like you to listen to your music loud, or don't really like the youth hanging out on the corner. So it becomes this thing of who's going to control the social space and whose mores and culture and reality is going to be the predominant thing that actually sits. And since it's a predominantly Black area, and it has been for the last 70 or so years, I would think that, you know, it should be what it is.
Yeah.
But something positive about this thing is that, you know, I was trying to buy a house 5 years ago. I couldn't get a $79,000 house in West Oakland 5 years ago. But now under gentrification, where the houses are now $500,000, I've been able to buy two or three of them. And, you know, that's due to this red line that gets lifted after gentrification starts. So it does, in this sick way, create an opportunity for people to begin to be able to build equity and have opportunities for ownership.
Marcel, that's a fascinating call. Thank you very much.
Welcome.
And good luck with your property. So we're going to continue talking about this issue when we come back from a short break. And later in the program, we'll also talk about the struggle to form a new government in Iraq, as the new prime minister there tries to look for nominees that everybody can agree on for various cabinet positions. Plus, the New York governor's race may have a new candidate, one from Massachusetts. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Today we're talking about gentrification with Lance Freeman, an assistant professor in urban planning program at Columbia University. He's with us from our bureau in New York. This is, of course, a political as well as an academic discussion. Joining us now is Patrick O'Connor, 40th Ward Alderman on the Chicago City Council for more than two decades now. He's joining us to discuss some of the challenges facing residents there as that neighborhood undergoes gentrification. Alderman, thanks very much for being with us.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Where's the 40th Ward and what's developing there?
Well, the 40th Ward is on the northwest, north-central side of the city of Chicago, about 5 miles, 4 miles from Wrigley Field for people who kind of know where that is located.
Sure,
in Chicago.
Yeah.
We've got, there's a number of things happening here. We've got a lot of condos in the pipeline, a lot of new construction on some streets where we're actually trying to encourage development to displace businesses that have been problems for our community. And we've got a lot of conversions going on in the interior residential streets of apartment buildings that are just finding their way into the condo system, if you will.
And are these developments engendering resentment?
Not throughout the ward. There are certain parts of my community, Rogers Park and Edgewater are two areas in Chicago that historically are very, very mixed, very diverse in terms of socioeconomic and racially and ethnically. And to some extent, there are some concerns in that area that if this continued, that there would be a displacement of some of the minority or some of the lower socioeconomic classes that exist there.
We've been hearing earlier in the program from various places that as places gentrify, they seem to get improved city services, everything from better trash collection to more police officers on patrol. What's your take on that?
I don't believe that that's a phenomenon that you see widespread in Chicago. I was discussing earlier in the day, in some instances, what happens is that as you get people that are a little bit wealthier, perhaps more educated, they work a system better, so they're able to get some more attention that people previously weren't. But the standpoint of the city is the city of Chicago doesn't go around saying, we'll respond to these folks because they're a little better heeled than the others. I mean, our patrolling strategy is based upon crime patterns and not based upon the wealth or the lack of wealth of a community. And in terms of refuge, each ward has its own ward superintendent. The alderman has significant input into who's picked for that job. If a ward is dirty, it tends not to be it's not the administration downtown that would be looked at least in our community. It would be the local aldermen and the people that they've chosen to do that work.
Yeah.
So it's not. I don't think it holds true as much as you might say it holds in other places.
Now, I can understand if you've got a strip of seedy motels through the neighborhood, you would encourage development to get rid of that. But how do you control it to keep it doing what you want it to do without changing the character of the neighborhood?
Well, I don't know that you can completely not change the character of a neighborhood, but in some instances you are trying to change the character of a street. I think what's happened a lot of times in cities is that people look at their residential area and tend to divorce themselves from their arterial streets. And so as they shop less and less locally, as they go to more centralized shopping locations, they demand less and less on their arterial streets. And if they begin to decline, it's a matter of time before it gets into the residential area. So we have some significant arterial streets in our community that we're trying to encourage development on. And to do that, we've engaged in some eminent domain condemnation and put some city services and city-related buildings there. And we're offering some premiums in terms of density or FAR to encourage people to come in and make some changes. But you kind of tend to differentiate between arterial and residential for those things.
Okay. Patrick O'Connor, good luck.
Thank you very much.
Patrick O'Connor, an alderman from Chicago, representing the north central section of the city, and he joined us from his office in Chicago. And let's get another caller on the line. And this is Greg calling. Greg's with us from Richmond, Indiana.
Yes, hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Thanks. I just have some concerns about the conclusion of the study. I'm a marketing researcher, and it sounds like we're just looking at transiency rates. In other words, the rate of how often people are moving in a given area. It sounds like he's looking at, you know, over a 10-year period of time. And how often people are moving may be interesting, but it's not telling us really anything about displacement, because it's not telling us who's moving in and who's moving out. So to conclude from the fact that the number of people moving isn't any different, that there's no displacement happening, I think is an erroneous conclusion from that kind of type of data.
Lance Freeman?
Well, the study not only looked at how quickly people move, but it also looked at the reason that they gave for moving, and it also looked at where they moved, and it also looked at who was moving into the neighborhood. So it's not
people who moved out of the neighborhood or just people in the neighborhood?
I'm sorry?
Did you sample people moving out of the neighborhood who had
right. The study follows people over time. So you can see when they move into the neighborhood, you can see if they move out of the neighborhood, and you can see if they do move out of the neighborhood, whether or not they move within the neighborhood or move outside of the neighborhood. And so you can get a sense of what are the characteristics of people moving in, what are the characteristics of the people moving out, and you could also get a sense of why they're moving out, because the survey asked people, why did you leave the neighborhood?
How did you collect that data?
I actually didn't collect it. I used data. This is a panel data collected by the University of Michigan. It's known as the Panel Study of Income Dynamics, and they've been following households going all the way back to 1968 all the way to the current year. They sampled the same households over time.
How many households are they sampling?
They started out with 5,000 households. It's since then expanded a great deal as people marry, as they have kids, and so forth. I think now it might be, I don't want to guess too much, but it's probably at least doubled or tripled in size.
Well, I feel like we're beginning to drown in the mire of methodology here.
One of the troubles with panel data is that people drop out of the panel. And so I wonder how a study like this would be compatible with that. But anyway.
All right, Greg, thanks for the call. We appreciate it.
Uh-huh.
And Professor Freeman, thank you very much for your time today. It's been an interesting conversation.
Thank you.
Lance Freeman is an assistant professor in the urban planning program at Columbia University, and he joined us from our bureau in New York.